for the wrong package. When nothing I was running out of my office. So this is going to be Torah Shabbat Beth.
All right.
So have we officially begun yet? Okay, so we were asked the question regarding witnesses and regarding the level in which witnesses are believed by a judge and what level of empathy is appropriate for a judge to extend to the witnesses. That's a good segue to my topic for tonight, and that is the topic of the credibility of witnesses and the qualifications to be a witness, or for that matter to be a dayan. What are the types of things that disqualify somebody from being able to serve in that capacity? Nowadays, when people come in front of the Beis Din for the hearings that take place in front of the Beis Din, we hear testimony from all kinds of individuals, from men, women, Jews, non-Jews. So the question arises, on some level, what about the requirement for Eidim Kasherim? That the Torah speaks about Pishnei Eidim, Shalosh Eidim, Yakum Dover, that we require that there be kosher witnesses who testify in front of the Beis Din. What if you have a case where the only people who have knowledge of the circumstances are not necessarily kosher? What does it take to be kosher? We derive from Shnei HaNoshim. First of all, they have to be men. They have to be bar mitzvah. They have to be kasherim, not related, not relatives to the parties. They have to be also kasherim in the sense that they have not violated serious averus that would cause them to become disqualified. So one threshold question is, what degree of validity or weight can be placed upon any kind of testimony that's rendered by people who don't fall into the classical categories of what would be Eidim Kasherim? We know that we make dispensations for certain types of situations where we allow people to come and testify who are not necessarily Eidim Kasherim, like if there is an Aguna case and a man is missing at sea, and we need to testify as to his whereabouts, if somebody saw that he died. So we have a principle there, Mishum Aguna Kilo Bei Rabbanan. The rabbis relaxed some of the evidentiary requirements in order to establish that a man has perished so that the wife is permitted to remarry. What's the basis? How are you allowed to do that? Generally speaking, we have the Gzeira Sakasa, Pishneidim, and Pishnayim Eidim. So how can you ever allow witnesses who are not kosher witnesses? How can you ever allow if you don't have two kosher witnesses and so forth? So the Gemara gives different dispensations. It says, Isha Daiko Mintzava, that really a woman is going to be very careful not to rely upon the testimony that is rendered without doing her own very careful and assiduous research. So therefore, that's one dispensation. And some of them, of course, should explain that it's like the Tosfos says, it's like an Akiras Dabim Min HaTorah. It's considered like sometimes in order to preserve the integrity of the entire system, the Chachamim established that we are allowed in certain cases to relax what would otherwise be the Torah requirements, and in order to enable women not to be agunot, so that allows for this special dispensation, even to the point that some say that we actually apply the principle when we're relying on an Eid Echad, for example, of Avkina Rabbanan the Kiddushin Mineh, that the Chachamim say, well, in this case, we'll consider it as if they were never married in the first place. So that's an extreme example. But as a general rule, if I require something which is the Kiyum HaDavar, what does it mean, the Kiyum HaDavar? I require an action to effectuate a change of status of a person of a particular party or a particular thing. Like, for example, I'm going to change a person's status from single to married. I'm going to change a person's status from married to divorced. In those situations, when I have the witnesses are not just being mevarer adavar, they're not just testifying about what happened. I could testify about a man's whereabouts, so you're testifying as to what happened, so maybe you can relax the requirements in certain cases. But if I'm testifying the kiyum adavar in order to effectuate a change in status, so then it simply doesn't work. There's a formula, it's like a mathematical formula. If you don't plug in the necessary equation, so then you're not going to be able to receive the result that you're looking for. If you don't have the two kosher witnesses, then you're simply not going to be able to get two people married according to Jewish law. If I don't have two kosher witnesses to witness the delivery of a get from a husband to a wife, then they're simply not going to be divorced according to Jewish law. So what we do is that we draw a distinction, first of all, between these two different types of situations. One, what we call a biror ledover situation, we're just trying to clarify the facts, and one is a kiyum ledover situation, where we have to effectuate an actual change in status. So if in a kiyum ledover situation, that would be non-negotiable. Biror ledover, that's more negotiable. Biror ledover is very interesting. The Rambam writes in one place that when the Torah says you require two witnesses, all that means is that if I have two valid witnesses, it's like a Zeros HaKosev, it's a Torah decree that if the Bezdin hears testimony from two kosher witnesses, then they're obligated to decide the case according to that testimony. You have to believe the two witnesses because that is what the Torah prescribes. If they satisfy all of the criteria to be kosher witnesses, so then you must dispose of the case based on their testimony, unless you see that it's a din meruma, unless you see that there's something very suspicious about the witnesses, so then you have to figure out a way to get around them. But if it's not a din meruma, so the Rambam says, that's the idea of two witnesses. But if I don't have two kosher witnesses, so what am I supposed to do? Just dismiss the case entirely? What if there's a very valid and legitimate claim that somebody else is just not able to produce two witnesses because when a certain event happened, there weren't two kosher witnesses? So there is a Ramah in Simon Lamed Hay in Choshen Mishpat, Sif Yudalit, he quotes a Truma Sedeshin. There was a Takana. There was a Takana that was made that, let's say, that one person wounds another individual. Well, let's say that there's a fight that breaks out in the Ezra's Noshim, behind the Mechitza, in the women's section. The only people who could have seen it were women. You didn't have kosher witnesses. You couldn't have summoned people to be there. If somebody is Mebazeh, Tamachokam, and the only people who were around to witness it were people who were not, strictly speaking, kosher witnesses. They were relatives. They were Ketanim. They were Noshim. So in that circumstance, we make there's a takana that we can accept the testimony of those individuals in those situations. So very often you have cases that come in front of the Bezdin. People are testifying about events that occurred. So you can't always necessarily have ensured that there be kosher witnesses who observed all of the proceedings and goings on. You have to make do, like this takana, with whoever happened to be around. The Sma asks the question that there seems to be a contradiction between this ruling of the Trumas of the Ramah based on the Trumas Adeshin of Simon Lamed Hei. There's another ruling in Choshen Mishpat Simon Tavches, which says that let's say that there is a negicha, one gore, an animal. Gore is another animal, and the only people who were around to witness this event were the stablers, the people who were hanging around as the shepherds and the sanitation workers, you know, who work in the barns and work in the farms and work in the stables. And otherwise, other than the stable hands, there were no kosher witnesses who could observe the event. So could you have these stable hands who might be non-Jews, who might be Ketanim, they might be, you know, the people who are not otherwise kosher witnesses, could they testify? And the halacha is paskin there in Simon Tavches, that you absolutely cannot rely upon their testimony. So the Sma in Simon Lamed Hei asks the question, why is it that over here we completely dismiss the possibility of relying upon such testimony? And Simon Lamed Hei, when it comes to the fight in the Ezra's Noshim, or it comes to, you know, even just a sudden altercation that breaks out, and there are no other kosher witnesses around, so here we are much more, or even that there's a woman who becomes a widow, and she gets to keep the clothes that she wore from their ex-husband's estate, and the only people who will pay attention to what a woman wears, even her own husband doesn't pay attention to what a woman wears usually, the only people who pay attention are the other women, you know, so therefore you have to rely upon their testimony. So then we say, okay, in that case, less brera. So the Sma answers that in the case of the animals that are goring each other, this is a very common type of nezik that occurs. And if we would be allowed to rely upon non-kosher witnesses in such a case, so then the in all our entire judicial system would be transformed, because so many of our cases involve these types of incidents. But the very unusual type of one-time incidents that are described in Siman Lamed Hey are events which are much less commonplace, and therefore we're not worried about compromising the entire judicial system by relying upon this type of testimony. So therefore, we will allow in the cases that we hear in front of our bezdin this type of testimony. That's one explanation. But a second explanation is, I'll take your question in just one moment, I see your hand is up. A second explanation is that, as the Rambam says, we're not paskening the case solely upon the testimony of these witnesses. We are using them, as Rabbi Mordechai Willich Shlita likes to say, as a source of background information. Nowadays, a bezdin is supposed to serve as an arbitration court. We hear cases not only based on strict din, but also pshara, that we're supposed to consider all the equities of the situation. Considering all the equities of the situation means that we're allowed to take into account various umdunus, things that establish circumstantial evidence, not for purposes like the Rambam says, if I have two kosher eidim, so I have no choice, I have to prosecute the case based on their testimony, but just to take it into consideration together with all the documentary evidence, together with all the testimony of the parties themselves, to take it into consideration in terms of rendering a final verdict, but not necessarily the same spirit that we would accept the testimony of Eidim Kesherim as something which is on this very high, exalted, sacrosanct level. Yes, your question.
I guess my question is primarily based on the first explanation, which is that Katanim, as a general rule, have no das at all. So how could their testimony mean anything in any case scenario?
This is a good question. One answer is the best answer to make the assessment as to the credibility of the Ketanim. It's not necessarily that we say, let's say I had a 10-year-old Ketan who was a Nobel Prize laureate, who was just like this tremendous, brilliant individual. So he still postulated this because he's not a Gadol. It's not only dependent upon a lack of das. Right? The Vilna Gaon, when he was 6 years old, he knew Baba Basa backwards and forwards, but he still couldn't be a kosher eid. So Bezdin has to make a determination with respect to their credibility. Secondly, the Piskei Tshuva quotes that there are opinions that say that where to the degree to which we accept this type of testimony doesn't mean in terms of establishing that a certain event happened altogether out of whole cloth. It means we know that something happened. We know the basic contours, but we're just trying to fill in the blanks. We're trying to fill in some of the missing pieces in terms of understanding the full picture. So in that sense, when it's just filling out the full picture, but we really sort of know what happened anyway, so then we're relying less upon their testimony. But I think that most poskim would say not necessarily like that opinion quoted by the Piskei Tshuva, even if it comes to really giving us the major pieces of substantive information. In these types of situations, we really have no alternative but to rely upon this testimony. Obviously, if it seems that there is something suspicious, so then you're not going to accept the testimony. It doesn't say in Shulchan Aruch that part of this takanas kadmonim was to accept the testimony of people who are rishayim, of people who are known to be wicked, people who are known to be liars. These people who have, some sort of basic credibility. One of the classic examples of this, which really does come up in situations of a modern day context as well, is a tshuva of the Shoal Umeshiv. I think it's Madura Kama Chelik Aleph Kuf Pei Hei. But as I said, I don't have my notes in front of me, so don't hold me to that, but it's probably close. The Shoal Umeshiv was asked about a school teacher. A school teacher was accused of molesting the students, okay? The only ones who were present in order to be able to testify about the molestation were the students themselves. It was a school teacher of small children. The small children didn't testify when they were still katanim. They testified, these were boys who were testifying that they were sodomized by the school teacher, and they testified after they had become gedolim. But nonetheless, even in that situation, we have a general principle that ketanim are not believed even after they become gedolim to testify about what happened when they were ketanim. Certainly when we're dealing with the araisa issues, they wouldn't have the ne'emanus. So Shaul HaMeshiv had to deal with a question that apparently when the rumors got out, or when word got out, that this school teacher was molesting his charges, So he was driven out of town, and he moved to another community. So that other community, the elders of the first town apparently did not send word to the other community about this person's various sins and flaws and his foibles, and he got a job as a school teacher in the other town. So the question was whether these other boys went to the other town and they testified about what happened. So should they, once this person was already hired by the other town, was it appropriate for him to lose his job under these circumstances? That was the question. So Sholem Eishiv quoted from this Ramah, he quoted from this Halakha, and he said, look, under most circumstances, we would require Edim Ksheirim to render the testimony, and not people who were Ketanim at the time, but when the molestation was taking place in the bedrooms or whatnot, you couldn't really expect that there would be other people sitting around. It's not as if you have, you know, seats and you invite people as a spectator sport to watch this type of a molestation, God forbid. And therefore, he says that the Ramah's principle goes into effect. So he said that on that basis, you have to, at the very least, as the Gemara says in Maseches Nida, mechash mi'abai, that when there's nobody else to testify and you have a testimony that seems pretty compelling and convincing from these ketanim about what this fellow did to them, so because we're dealing with the highest level of responsibility within our community of being a teacher of our impressionable small children, under these circumstances, for sure, you have to take the testimony seriously, even to the degree, says, not only of not offering the job in the first place, but even if the job had already been offered, the job offer should be rescinded and the person should be dismissed based on the testimony that the Ketanim are rendering. Yes.
Yeah, the argument that
you made, after they became Gadol.
Okay, the argument that you made before that we use the Ramah and the Tumas Hadeshen to accept all of these things, that would be only the Beis Din as it's constituted now, that it's a Beis Din from Pshara, as opposed to during the time of the Gemara.
No, even if the Beis Din, again, of course we're dealing with the Beis Din that's not Smukim, but no, I mean, I gave that as sort of a second consideration, but that's not built into this Pesach. The Ramah says, even if I had a Beis Din that was convened, it's true, it's not Smukim, but we're still operating like the Beis Din. Even if you have a Beis Din convened to decide the case according to strict din, this could be a case where this could be incorporated into the din. Now, maybe it would be some sort of a necessary pshara component that even a Beis Din that's sitting in strict din would have to incorporate. But that's also part of our contemporary Shulchan Aruch, that sometimes we say that we have to incorporate these types of notions.
So how far? So how far can we stretch this concept of using it?
But not to Goring.
So that's the question.
So why not Goring? Why not the case of Goring?
Because the case of Goring is too common. It's too commonplace. That was the idea.
That's the problem.
That was too common. It's too commonplace.
So burglary.
You would have nothing left of the entire system. You would have nothing left of the system under those circumstances. Yes. Oh, yes, you did though.
Would the Truma suggestion make us look if the Ketan were not Gadol?
I don't think so. No, because his case, the Tumas Hadeshin himself was speaking about actual Ketanim. The Sholem Eishiv's case was the Ketanim who became Gadolim. The question wouldn't be on the Tumas Hadeshin, it would be on the Sholem Eishiv. Would he have accorded the same way? I don't know, because that wasn't his case and he didn't speak to that per se. So the Sholem Eishiv, though, does not stops at a certain point. He says this is in order to be able to deal with the actual situations in front of us, to function as a community, that we have some type of an assault took place and we have to be able to bring offenders to justice, so we have to be able to deal with these types of dispensations. However, he says that nonetheless, in order to passel somebody, in order to invalidate somebody as a witness altogether, he said, there you need Edim Ksheirim. Because why? That is a real change of status. Remember, we spoke about a change of status. I'm changing a person's status. I can use this type of testimony to say that A will owe B $100. Or even to say that it's appropriate under these circumstances that we're not going to let somebody serve in a certain job capacity in the community. But this does not give me the right to say that this person is an absolute Rasha. Because in order to be able to label somebody and to brand somebody as a Rasha, so then I need the testimony of Edim Ksheirim to do so. So Sholem Eishiv seems to very clearly indicate, in the course of his tshuva, he said, Because people asked him about this tshuva. After he wrote this tshuva, so he had all kinds of critiques. People asked him questions about it. Half of the tshuva is the tshuva, and half of the tshuva are his answers to the critiques. It's very, very interesting. So he writes, well, I'm not looking to apostle this person le'edus, to say that this person is apostolate. All that I am doing is to say that we have to take this testimony seriously so that this individual shouldn't serve as a school teacher of our children. That's all. So we do draw a distinction in this regard. This is very, very important, because this will come up from time to time, that you will hear things about an individual that will make you very, very concerned about job credentials, perhaps, of the individual. But it doesn't necessarily mean that if this individual was an eight kiddushin, that we're going to invalidate the kiddushin and say that the couple has to get married again. Or if this person signed as an eight for a get, that we're going to invalidate the get. What is necessary in order to invalidate somebody as an aid? So it says, Altashis Yotkoim Rashali Yose Eid Chamas. So you're not supposed to deal with somebody to be who's a Rasha, to be an aid, and we use the word Chamas. Chamas is usually a term that alludes to somebody who is dishonest in their monetary dealings, because we're afraid that they're going to take money from somebody in order to render false testimony. However, if the person does not have a reputation of committing sins that are not related to Hamas, where a person is not, you know, on the weak side, that they're going to do things with te'ovon, just because it's more expedient for them to do a certain aveiro, because they're going to get a monetary benefit from it. But let's say the person does aveiros because he's just a genuinely bad person, because he really has a very rebellious attitude towards his religion and towards God, but not that he's somebody who has a history or a reputation of taking bribes, or somebody who could be swayed to do things because he has a love for money, because he has a love for pecuniary benefit. So that's a machlokis between Abaye and Rava in the Gemara, and it's one of the cases where we pask it like Abaye against Rava. We pask it like Abaye against Rava in six instances. They're called Yalkagam, okay? One of the Yalkagam cases, or one of the letters of the mnemonic, or of the Rosh Tevos of Yalkagam, stands for is the Ayin, right? The Yalkagam. So that's Ayin stands for aid, right? Okay, so that's going on aid zomim. That's one case of aidim that they argue about. And another one is the mem at the end, which is going on mumar, okay? Mumar is, I have a bad guy. I have two types of bad guys, okay, rebellious guys. One is a muma okel nevelos l'te'avon. One person is somebody who eats non-kosher because it costs less money to buy non-kosher meat than kosher meat. So he's doing it for pecuniary purposes. So he would be a rasha d'chamas. And the other type of muma is a muma okel nevelos l'hachos. He's doing it because he just has this beef with God, and he's doing it out of pure rebelliousness. So Rava says, Muma Oka Nebelos L'Teyavon is definitely possible Eidus, because he's a Rosh of the Hamas. And Abaye says, even a Muma Oka Nebelos L'Hachis is possible Eidus. Why? Because he's a Rosh. And he focuses not on the word Hamas, but he focuses on the word Rosh. He says, the Torah says, Atashis Yotkoim Rosh, Yos Eid Hamas, Atashis Rosh Eid. And a Rasha cannot be an aid. Forget about the Chumas. If a person is called a Rasha, then he can't not be an aid. He's not allowed to be a witness. If you commit an offense of eating the Velos, then that is an offense that receives a punishment of Malkus. And we know that anybody who commits an offense for which they would receive Malkus is considered a Rasha. How do we know that? Because it says in the Torah, V'ayayim bin hakos ha-Rasha. If somebody is culpable of deserving of Malkus and bin hakos, Rasha, then he's considered to be a Rasha. So therefore, anybody falls into that category who would receive Malkus for an offense that they commit, they're a Rasha, and they will be Pasul Eidus, and that's how we pass him like Abaye against Rava. As another ramification as well. If a person is a Rasha, so from the point in time in which we know that the person is a Rasha, they're going to become Pasul Eidus from that moment in time. So that relates to the other machlokus between Abaye and Rava about the Eid Zomen. A person is found to be an Eid Zomen. So when do they become an Eid Zomen? They testified on Tuesday against somebody, okay, and they were lying the entire time. they were really in a different location from the location where they purported to see the incident. The incident occurred on Monday. Supposedly occurred on Monday. They testify on Tuesday. Turns out Monday they were somewhere else. And then Thursday, the other set of Adim comes along and says when they claimed on Tuesday that they were testifying about what happened on Monday, they were really somewhere else, and we're testifying that they were Adim Zomimim, that they were testifying falsely, so they become puzzled. What point in time do they become puzzled? Do they become puzzled on Monday, on Tuesday, or on Thursday? From what point in time? So Monday, nothing happened. They hadn't testified yet. So they're certainly still kosher on Monday, right? However, they testified on Tuesday. So they became Rishayim on Tuesday. We only found out about their rishus on Thursday when the other set of Adim testified against them. So Rabbi says, oh, we only found out on Thursday. So therefore, they only become puzzled starting on Thursday. Because maybe they signed contracts on Wednesday. And on Wednesday, other people were counting on them in order to make the contracts valid. So they didn't know that they were non-kosher witnesses. And it's not fair to all these people who employ these individuals that was witnesses on Wednesday that all these contracts should be struck down as invalid. So therefore, only from the point in which the whole world knows that they were non-kosher witnesses, only from that point should they be invalid, starting from Thursday, when the other set of Adim came along. Abaye says, and this is consistent with the other opinion of Abaye, so he kind of gets, two halakos in his favor for the price of one, okay, both the ayin and the mem of Yalkagam. He says it's all dependent upon being called a rasha. When were they a rasha? They were proven to have been rishayim from the time in which they committed their act of rishus. Their act of rishus, when they testified falsely, took place on Tuesday. Therefore, they become invalid witnesses starting on Tuesday. L'mafreya, eight zomim l'mafreya who nifsol. So here as well, we paskin like Abaye. So therefore, if a person is really shown to be a rasha, then they become puzzled from the time in which they became a rasha. A person could be an aid for many, many years. If it turns out then that witnesses come along and testify that they were rishab, they've been aid them on documents for the last 10 years. Witnesses come along and say 11 years ago they did an act which makes them into rishayim. We don't have any evidence that they did tshuva after that point in time. So then they are considered to be rishayim from 11 years ago, and everything that they testified about during this entire period of time is struck down. However, it has to be a type of case where the Torah actually describes them as rishayim. We've identified one such case. We've identified maybe two such cases. One is a Rosh Hashanah. At the very least, we're going to go with the Gzeiras HaKasuf. If they did anything on a Torah level, that they were thieves, they were robbers, they stole, and committed a Gezel on a Daraisa level, they committed theft of a person's property that would be defined as theft on a Torah level, so then for sure we would have to be worried that they're going to testify falsely for pecuniary gain, so they're certainly false, so they're certainly considered to be invalid. Second category is if they're Chayav Malkus, they committed a Mavera, for which they would be Chayav Malkus, considered to be Yah in Bin Akos HaRasha, right? Third category, Asher Hu Rasha Lamus. We have another pasuk in the Torah that says, if your person is a rasha, that they committed an act of wickedness for which they would be liable to receive the death penalty, either karis or a misa or a misas bezdin, any type of misa, if they did the nevera for which they would receive a misas bezdin, so then for sure they would be chayiv as well. So that, for example, a person is they would be invalid as a witness as well. If they're mechal Shabbos before hesya, that's a classic case, right? That's why we always ask if people are called up to be witnesses at a wedding. So I remember when I was once designated, when I was younger, so I wasn't a rabbi yet, I didn't look like I necessarily was the abbezdin of Chicago, so I was maybe a 20-year-old law student, or 22-year-old law student. One of my friends from the law school was getting married. In those days, it wasn't customary that you called up like the biggest rabbanim in town to be the Eidei Kiddushin. You called up your friends to be the Eidei Kiddushin. That was the minhag way back then. And therefore, they called me up to be an eighth kedusha. I think Rav Heideman was the Masada Kedushin. First time I met Rav Heideman, so Rav Heideman turns to me and the other witness and said, "Are you Shomer Shabbos?" You know, so I understand the question. So that's, you know, a fundamental requirement of being a kosher egg. You have to be Shomer Shabbos. Fortunately, I was able to answer yes. Shomer Shabbos.
When I was an aide at a friend's wedding, Moshe Hirschler was Masada Kedushin. He turned to me and said, "He mahar her b'tshuva."
Yes. Now we say that any time that we have aid and sign a get, the first part of the get procedure is we turn to the sofer and we say the writing materials belong to you, so you can give them over to the husband, so that the husband will own the writing materials. Very important. And secondly, the second question we ask is to the witnesses. We say, please be introspective and repent. He mahar her b'tshuva, so that we can ensure, as to the best of our ability, that they're going to be kosher edim. So this is a big deal. So being Machal Shabbos makes a person a pasul eid. Why? A person isn't necessarily doing it for pecuniary benefit, but a person, it's an offense for which an individual would be chayav misa, and therefore they're defined as a rasha. Since we say atashis rasha eid, anytime that a person is a rasha, they become an eid pasul, so therefore that also will make a person an eid pasul. But if the offense is such that it does not incur a chiyav malchus, and it does not incur a chiyav misa, and it's not a rasha de chamas, it's some other offense in the Torah, like a lav she'en bo maisa type of thing, so that would not cause a person to become pasul eidus min the Torah. They would only become pasul eidus min the Rabbanan. So the Gemara says, Rabbah has a very good argument. Rabbah has a very good argument that it's not fair to the rest of the world out there that people become psulim le'edus. They're going to say that before we found out that they did something that would make them psul le'edus, they signed as a witness and all these other documents, and people are going to lose out because it'll turn out their contracts were invalid. So therefore, Rabbah had said, with an eid zomim, you should wait until the shas hachrozi. You should wait until the official public service announcement is made that these people are considered to be psulim le'edus. Like, for example, you find out that somebody is a scoundrel and you throw them out of the shul. So at that point, that's considered to be a shas hachroza. Yes, the point has been made in the public consciousness that this person was invalid, but they didn't know beforehand. So the Gemara says, we don't accept that Rabbah is a shita when it comes to an eid zomim, because that's a puzzle. That's somebody who's considered to be a rasha, and he's puzzle eidus on a Torah level. But whenever we puzzle somebody later on a Rabbanan level because they violated some other Aveira for which there's neither Malkus nor Miso, or maybe it's an Aveira Rabbanan or something like that, so then they only become Pasul Mishas Achroza. If they committed the Aveira 10 years ago, but we only find out about it now, so they're not Pasul retroactively going back the past 10 years, they only become Pasul from today forward. So this is very, very important, because at the same degree to which we have these concerns regarding an aid, we also have the same concerns regarding a dayan. Anything that postles an aid will also postle a dayan. There's a question, Rabbi Akiva Eger quotes a machlokis. It's a machlokis with respect to a dayan. Do we treat a dayan perhaps more stringently than an aid? Do we say that only with respect to an aid, if it's not something that postles him on a deraisa level, then we'll only invalidate the aid nishasa chorosa from the time of the announcement going prospectively but not retrospectively? With a dayan, we're going to pasul the dayan retrospectively. So he quotes the Knesset Sagadola, who says we're going to pasul the dayan even retrospectively, and then he quotes the Sefer Esos Noshim that says that no, the same rules that apply to an aid would apply to a dayan. This is important because we had an incident a few years ago where there was somebody who had a reputation of being a kosher dayan. He sat on many different cases of geiros, and then it was found that he was accused of doing some very, very hideous things. Very hideous things. Now, what were the hideous things that he did? The hideous things he had to do with, for example, placing a camera in a mikvah and looking at women. Now, what's the aveira there? It's nishmatim b'kod davarav lo sasu acharei levavchem. These types of aveiros that are not aveiros that would incur malchus per se. So therefore, those are the types of aveiros that only invalidate mitra banan. If you're going to treat the dying the same as the aid, as Rabbi Akiva Eger seems to indicate, because he seems to come out in favor of the second approach, and this also appears to be the approach in the Ramah, in the Shulchan Aruch as well, then it would follow that he would only become invalid from the Shas Hachroza, from the time in which these things were discovered, okay? But there's a second requirement as well in order to invalidate somebody, and that is that you only invalidate somebody on the basis of, remember what the Sholem Eshev said. It's one thing to rely on circumstantial evidence and testimony if you need to adjudicate a monetary case or to be able to figure out what's in the best interest of the community going forward, because you don't have the luxury of having Eidim Kesherim. But when it comes to causing somebody to be an Eid Pasul, so then that only happens if I have Shnei Eidim Kesherim. In fact, the Gemara has different stories of somebody who is a Malve Beribis, he loaned Beribis, and the Gemara shows very clearly he would only be invalidated as an Eid when there were two different witnesses who came along and were able to testify that this was somebody who loaned Beribis. But otherwise, he wouldn't have been invalidated. There's a story of this Baal Chama person who was indicted for some criminal act, and he was going to, for I think murder, he was going to be put to death, and Rapapa came along and saved the day and demonstrated that one of the two witnesses who testified against him was a pasul witness, therefore there weren't two kosher witnesses. So what we see is that there is, we require under all circumstances that we have kosher, that we have to have two kosher eidim. Okay, very important that we always have to have two kosher eidim, not only to put somebody to death, but we require two kosher eidim in order to establish that somebody is that somebody is possible. I'm sorry, the case of Baal Chama was where there were he was establishing that one of the two witnesses was who testified against him was invalid, and therefore that's why he wasn't right. Okay,
but we could do the reverse. We could kosher retroactively aiding. Let's say for the last 5 years this person was being over a neder regularly. He had a neder and he was violating his neder constantly,
yes.
Regularly. He's a Rasha for violating. Now 5 years later he does a Torah Sidorim. Torah Sidorim is retroactively. So we would kosher him for the last 5 years, no?
That's a different story when we're dealing with things like a tourist in Durham. That's, you know, sort of in a different, you know, category, shall we say. Right here, we're talking about the types of averas that can't be undone. Yes, if an avera can be undone, it's an interesting, you know, question. But generally speaking, when we say that a person does tshuva from being pasul eidus, it doesn't mean that they become kashul eidus retroactively. It means that mikana lahaba, they become kashul eidus
for
tshuva purposes. So tourist in Durham, I don't know. That's an interesting question for a separate discussion. What happens if we do a Taras Nedarim in terms of do you, all your Averus become obliterated retroactively? It's a whole discussion, you know, among the Rishonim, but I don't want to focus upon that because it's really a separate topic for discussion. But most of the cases are not going to be a person who violates, you know, Nedarim per se. Most of the cases are going to, you know, come more into this particular category where we're dealing with people who did, you know, real Averus. But but we only, you know, found out about it later. So again, we said that if it's a chi of malchus, a chi of misa, so then they can become pasul retroactively. But we require two kosher eidim. If the only way that we know is, let's say the person admits it themselves. So then we have a principle, eidim mesim misatzma rasha, that a person cannot invalidate themselves, okay? So therefore, even if a person confesses to a crime, that doesn't make them pasul. We might say we don't want to use them anymore because they confess to a crime. However, that doesn't make them pasul le'edus on that basis. Or if the only people around were not eidim shemus, so you'll say, well, if a person's offenses occurred like in a mikvah, so most of the people who are going to be in the mikvah might be women, for example, who otherwise wouldn't be, you know, shem le'edus. Maybe that falls into the sholem meshiv category. Yes, it does in terms of enforcing justice against this individual. However, it doesn't in terms of just the technical legal requirement of what is necessary to make a person pasul le'edus. Now, a dayan can become pasul for being a dayan on grounds in addition to doing something for which they be chayav malchus or doing something for which they be chayav misa. If they're yadua le'ganayis, the Chazon Ish writes, they did something or they become a living chil Hashem. because there are certain qualities they're supposed to have as a dayan, qualities of honesty, qualities of integrity, qualities of comportment, of having a good name, and they develop such a bad name that they're just a disgrace to the entire community. So therefore, that would be considered a disqualification. But again, that disqualification only occurs from the moment in time in which that happens, when the moment in time in which the person becomes a disgrace, not the moment in time in which they were. That could even be potentially on a deraisa level, but it's own. But again, this is not that they are puzzled because of the averus they committed. They're puzzled because they became disgraceful. So that's the psul. The nature of the psul is once they yadua l'ganai, they don't have the qualifications. They stand apart from the rest of the population, not in terms of having the qualities that the attributes that would make them more worthy of being a dayan, but they have the attributes that would make them less worthy than everybody else of being a dayan, the chazanish writes. So then that would cause them to become disqualified. But again, not because of the avera, but because of the reputation. So therefore, there as well, it stands to reason that you would look at the moment in time in which they develop this negative reputation. So if you are armed, I guess, with all of these different considerations, you look at the Lashon of the Rambam. The Rambam writes, why is it, as a general rule, that unless I have a situation where I have two Eidim Sheirim that are testifying about somebody that they committed a Chiyuv Makos, or they committed a Chiyuv Misa, or they did something which is Rashi the Chamas, that why is it that I only disqualify people Mishas Achrosa, from the moment in time in which they're Yadua Lignai, they get expelled from their congregation, they get thrown into jail, whatever, you know, it certainly would qualify as a Shas Achrosa? He says it's because it's the Zechus Ha'am. Because otherwise, people are going to be damaged. The example that was given in the Gemara is that people will be damaged because they'll have their contracts invalidated, and therefore all of their monetary transactions are going to be voided. So some of the Rishonim said, or some of the Poskim say, oh, so that's only when I'm dealing with a type of testimony that is going to have ramifications for sellers and purchasers, for lekuchos. However, if it is a testimony like on a get, it's a testimony for a marriage where there's no monetary ramification per se, it's just in the realm of Issa Beheter, so maybe then we would invalidate everybody retrospectively as opposed to prospectively. If you look at the Rambam, the Rambam's Lashon is not, I'm worried about Tekanas Lekuchos, the Rambam's Lashon is, I'm worried about Zuchus Ha'am, I'm worried about the welfare of the population. What does it mean? I'm worried about the welfare of the community. What it means, arguably, is that the Rambam is taking this a step further, and you see this possibility hinted to in the Nemuke Yosef as well, when he comments on the sugya, that Zuchus Ha'am is more encompassing, presumably, than just worrying about monetary transactions. So Zuchus Ha'am is a person converted, and they thought that they were Jewish, and now we're going to strike down one of the Dayanim and say, oh, this Dayan is going to be invalidated by us retrospectively. Well, if it's not necessary for us to do that, according to Torah law, then it's not a good idea for us to do that, because then you're undercutting the Zuchus Ha'am. You're taking away from the wealth of the community. People converted, they got married, they built families, the children in certain cases got married themselves, and now you're going to say about everybody, none of you are Jewish, and you all have to reconvert. So that's going to be a tremendous pagam. It's going to be a tremendous blow towards the Zuchus Ha'am, towards the welfare of the community. So therefore, we can understand, based on the Rambam, in the context of the Halacha, why we have such rigorous standards before we can make somebody puzzle Eidus. Now, that being said, okay, let me take a question.
There's times when you want to puzzle Eidus, the puzzle of a wedding for a head and a
good. Ah, so this is a different story. So then let's get to Rav Moshe. So Rav Moshe said, if we're always going to require the standard of the two witnesses who are coming, and some say the two witnesses who come and they testify even in front of the Beis Din, so we're going to have a problem on our hands. Because certainly in America, what ended up happening is that you had a lot of people outside of the observing community, maybe their parents that belonged to Orthodox shuls, they got married by rabbis, they got married in wedding ceremonies, but then they didn't receive gittin afterwards, they didn't receive kosher gittin. So this can create a problem of adultery when the women subsequently get remarried and when they have children from the next husband, so then the children could be mamzerim. So Moshe said, well, that is only a problem if when they got married in front of kosher witnesses. But if everybody was at the wedding, and certainly, you know, the people who were standing around the chuppah, they were all mechalei Shabbos, these were non-Orthodox weddings, and you can't assume that everything was done al pi halacha, and the witnesses themselves were not shomrei Shabbos, so then we can strike down the weddings, because we didn't have shomrei Shabbos, they were mechalei Shabbos, therefore the people were psulim le'edus, and therefore, halakhically, again, I want to emphasize, this is a special kula, special leniency in a case where the husband didn't give the get. But the chatzkila, Moshe, was of course koshesh for the opinion of Apenkin and the others, who said that even in such a case, just the mere fact they were living together is considered to be edus to the entire world that they were married to each other, and that of course you do need a get. But at least to prevent aguna situations and mamzera situations, Moshe was prepared in cases where assiduous research is performed to be mako. We still tell people, and this is a very important rule of thumb, not to paskin for yourself regarding these matters, that whenever possible you always should take care of a get in any situation where people are living together as husband and wife, even if they just got married in front of a justice of the peace in a civil ceremony. However, Moshe was prepared to be lenient in these extraordinary situations. So the question is, he asked this question himself, that he didn't go around collecting testimony about these people that they were Mechal Shabbos. It was just because it was generally known that they were Mechal Shabbos. So he articulates a principle, and we find this principle in the Gemara as well, of Anan Sadi. Sometimes we say, we, the entire world, we are the witnesses that some Mechal Shabbos. Even if nobody officially came forward in front of the Beis Din to testify that somebody, say, in the Reform community is Mechal Shabbos, everybody knows that they're driving to the golf course, you know, every single Saturday morning. Everybody knows that they're being Mechal Shabbos, that they're running around in their vehicles, that they're mowing their lawn, that they're doing Melachos Shabbos. Every single Shabbos, or you know, the synagogue is located 100 miles or 50 miles away from where they live, and somehow they're making their way to synagogue. So we know that they're being Mechal Shabbos. So he said, when I have an unsadi, I don't need that the actual witnesses came forward. The whole world knew for the past 20 years. Let's say the wedding took place 15 years ago. So the whole world knew during the past 20 years that this person was a Mechal Shabbos, even without any testimony being rendered. However, that's only if the whole world knew. If a person was committing averos, and it was not an avera that the whole world knew, everybody was shocked to discover it because the person was in good standing, they were a member of the Orthodox community, in certain cases they were even a rabbi, so then we don't apply this principle of anansadi. We could say that at the point in time in which the newspapers are blaring, or the newspapers are publicizing every single day the terrible offenses that this person is accused of doing, and after a while people kind of come to the conclusion that where there's a significant smoke, there's fire, that the person really is doing all of these things. So from that moment in time, we can say, not necessarily that even there is an anansadi that the person was doing, because during all of that time, there wasn't an anansadi that the person was doing. All of those things. However, we have right now, certainly that people have this notion of the individual, that is their impression at this point in time of the individual. But again, if it's not based on Shnei Edim Kesherim, and there was no anansadi while all of this was going on, so then the main grounds for the invalidation at this point in time will be Yadua Liganai, that the person is Achil Hashem at this point in time. So that's why you're invalidating the person, because they're Achil Hashem, but not that you're invalidating them for this specific offense, because you don't have the necessary criteria. It was not known during all of this time that the person was committing these offenses.
Anansadi is not testimony.
Anansadi is not actual aid. Testimony. It's just, that, it's just that we know. We know. That's all. We know. But again, that requires actual knowing. That, that everybody knows the person was running around being Machal Shabbos. Again, we may dismiss somebody from a post based on testimony of not even sharing, based on their own hodas baldin, their own hodas baldin, so to speak, their own confessions. But that's not enough to be postal somebody le'edus, as you know. Based on, you know, according to the according to the mainstream, you know, sources and opinions. Yes. Is that enough to invalidate the kiddushin? So, if you had a marriage, and then it turns out that you, when you do your research, that the witnesses. They were married already, but nonetheless, it turns out that the witnesses were Mechalel Shabbos. So there, it's a little bit more complicated. If it's, let's say, a non-Orthodox wedding, and nobody there was Shomer Shabbos, and you know just based on the community where they came from that everybody was Mechalel Shabbos, so then you could say that halakhically speaking, that wouldn't be a kosher wedding. That's what Moshe Feinstein argues. And if it wasn't a kosher wedding, and the husband refuses to give a get, so then there's room to permit the woman to remarry without a get. That's what he was talking about.
The whole crowd, if there are two kosher.
Yes. So again, if there was an Orthodox wedding, yeah, and
we designate only two.
And you designated only two, that's much more complicated. Some say, well, these were the two who were designated, and therefore, if they're no good, or one of them is no good, the whole wedding is no good. And others would say, no, that since everybody else at the wedding was a kosher witness, the mere fact that these two were designated meant that they were designated, unless they're no good, in which case everybody else is designated.
So is it better not to designate them? In case something's wrong with those two? So it's better not to make that announcement to the exclusion of everybody else?
Some say that it's good to designate because without a designation, arguably the non-kosher witnesses are included together with a group together. So it's something, I think Rav Soloveitchik used to say, I'm designating these people to the exclusion of everybody else. Some people say, I'm designating these two people to the exclusion of all non-kosher witnesses. Right. Yeah. And others say, I'm designating these two people, and it's understood, of course, the exclusion of all non-kosher witnesses. I'm designating them because I think they're kosher, they're not kosher, others can step in. So in an Orthodox wedding, it's much more difficult. There are those who are prepared to rely upon that rationale. They were designated, and therefore they're non-kosher, then the entire wedding is no good, but that's much more of a chiddush. I don't think Rav Moshe ever went that far. When he was talking about an Orthodox wedding, he only went that far when he was talking about non-Orthodox weddings. Right, that's right.
Well, that's the point. That's the whole thing.
If the wedding was no good, why do you want to get to begin with? Oh, so that's what we were discussing. Exactly. And then because there are other opinions who disagree, and they say whenever anybody lives together as husband and wife, even if there are no kosher witnesses at the wedding, the mere fact that we know that they're living as husband and wife creates a knowledge that the whole world has that they're really married. To which Rav Moshe would respond that marriage has to be created. There has to be a das. There has to be an intention on the part of the husband and the wife to get married at that particular moment in time. When they're living together subsequently as husband and wife, they're not living with each other with the intention of creating a marital relationship. They only had that intention at that one moment in time. At that one moment in time, there were no kosher witnesses. That's basically the nekuda samachlokis.
If the woman had gone and had a second marriage without a get, and that second marriage is a kohen, then we wouldn't want to give her a get, right? Just as a chumrah from that first marriage. Well,
because you say, because then it would create a reach again.
A problem
in general, you're right, but not entirely. Because we're more concerned, many posts can take the position, including myself and my colleagues, that we'd rather deliver a get under those circumstances in order to obviate the concern, at least according to certain post-game, that she's committing adultery, than to worry about the reacha get issue, which is at best some sort of a rabbinic concern that a woman who received a get that she didn't really need to receive can't marry a kohen. According to many poskim, she really still can marry a kohen, so therefore it's easier to be lenient about that issue than to be lenient about a concern that a woman is an eishes ish and that the children might be mamzerim, that people won't want to marry the children. So that's really the approach that we generally follow. You're correct that there are those who follow that approach, but that's not the approach that we generally follow. It's a very good question.
It's only
though.
The issue on the kohen, not yeah. even on the woman.
That's not entirely clear. That's not entirely clear. That's a machlokus as well. But David Zvi Hoffman said that way, but I don't think that the majority of poskim are in agreement with that proposition. Most poskim would say that it's a problem for the women. So I think Ramoshi himself says it's a problem for the woman herself, not only for the kohen.
Yeah. I think the Gemara uses that as an example where talking about shlichut, where a kohen is sending a woman to do
society.
You want to try to bring a riot? You can show me any Gemara you want, but
it's okay. No, 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 it's
okay. Yeah, but I'm not convinced. Yes. What? Right. So then again, that would be another example. If you could go back to the original wedding and show that there were no kosher wedding witnesses at the original wedding, it could be grounds for leniency. A betting can declare him dead if they have sufficient evidence to demonstrate that he's really dead. I mean, we dealt with that in the aftermath of the World Trade Center, where in certain cases we didn't have the remains of the husbands, but we had very strong evidence, testimony demonstrating that they were in places where they couldn't possibly have escaped from when the building was struck, and we knew they were inside the building. So therefore, based on the various rules of evidence that are recorded in the Gemara, we were able to conclude that the husbands were dead. But that wasn't some extraordinary conclusion that the Gemara, that the Beis Din came to. That was all based on the standards of evidence that are articulated in the Gemara. It's not enough in and of itself. It's a more complicated discussion. There's a Risha named Abeliezer Mivodon who said that if he disappeared in a way in which there is a probable conclusion that he died, it's just that it's not an absolute certainty that he died, because we could also figure out the possibility that he might be alive somewhere, but there's like more than a 50% possibility that he died based on the circumstances of his disappearance. So then after a certain amount of time has lapsed, then the wife would be allowed to remarry. But you would have to establish, you know, even according to Rabbi Eliezer Mivodon, there has to be some sort of a probability of death. It can't just be, you know, a simple disappearance. Then, right, if it's just disappearance without anything else, that becomes much more difficult. To what degree do you rely upon this notion of mevad zichro, that the person's memory has been forgotten because they've been missing for so long? That doesn't by itself establish an automatic presumption of death. However, it is something which, combined together with other considerations, can be taken, betok ha-keshbon, can be taken into the general calculus. How much time do we have?
A couple of minutes.
Okay. So again, you have to be able to know all of the rules. Like one other thing the Gemara says, that sometimes a person could do an Avera for which they really would have been disqualified, but if they thought that it wasn't an Avera because everybody does it and therefore people don't take it that seriously, that also doesn't make them psum leidus. Like there was the people that used to bury individuals who died on the first day of Yontif, which is an Avera, Mina Torah, to bury, you know, to dig a ditch and dig a grave and bury somebody the first day of Yontif. But they weren't considered to be psulim the edus, says the Gemara, and that's because they thought they were doing a big mitzvah. So the Gemara says, yeah, but the Chachamim were like, you know, giving them, you know, punishment for what they were doing. It's like, yeah, they thought that was part of the mitzvah, that they're supposed to do the mitzvah for which they'll get expiation afterwards, but that's all part of what the Chachamim want them to do. They just didn't get it. So Rav Avadia Yosef talks about somebody who signed as an aide on Gittin for many years, and it turned out that he shaved his beard with a razor, which is an Issamalkus. But even though it's an Issamalkus, he says it doesn't invalidate the person at Darais level, only on a Durabatan level, because he didn't think that it was really an Avera, because all of his friends did it. And therefore, he's only possible Mishas HaKrosa, and therefore, the Gittin were Kesherim. We found this happened to him, and this happened, this was in Egypt. It happened to him in his own Beis Din. I had a case where a person, it turned out, we discovered not here in Chicago, we also, a person that we hardly ever used as a name, we used him like once or twice, then I was told by the secretarial staff, oh, you know, this person doesn't file tax returns, he's not, you know, honest with his taxes. So I asked the Rabbi Wig at the time, and he said, look, unfortunately, many people think that it's mutter to cheat on your taxes, so therefore, that wouldn't necessarily possible him, per se, and also, we didn't have two aides who testified that he did that, but I still didn't use him again. But you have to know all of these rules so that you can understand the parameters of flexibility. The bottom line is, it's extremely important, a person's going to be an aide, or maybe called upon to be an aide, to comport yourself in a fashion which is completely above board and is with absolute halakhic integrity. So you should aspire to be a kosher aide. You should do tshuva every day of your life. It applies how much more so, just, you know, exponentially, to people who are dayanim, if we serve in that capacity, then it's very important to try to be as scrupulous as possible in our personal and professional behavior. Okay, stop here.
If a person saw, witnessed something at the center and then the tshuva afterwards,
he did what?
If he witnessed something at the center and then the tshuva.
He witnessed something at